Well,
they are
not from another. They're made by a lovely friend of mine now, sadly dead friend of mine, who. And they're basically a replica of an old bardic instrument called the silver branch. So if a bard would come into, and they represent the sound of silver hawk bells. And they represent that movement between from the movement between things, the movement from inside to outside or outside to inside, and the images of a hawk leading you into the other world or leading you out of the other world. And there's a lot of old Welsh and Irish stories about the silver branch and people hearing the silver branch and crossing across the worlds. So it's quite a nice. This is a very interesting one. This one because it was made. A very good friend of mine from Dorset, but the wood comes from, wood actually is ebony from Egypt, from Aswan in Egypt, and the hawk bells come from Afghanistan, so they're it's an ancient...
Their natural habitat?
Yeah, they are. They come, you can't get them anymore, because the family who made them have vanished in the Afghanistan troubles, but they came from Afghanistan, from family in Afghanistan. Wood comes from part of a longer staff I had that I got from Aswan. And then my good friend Jane worked on it and made it into the silver branch. I sort of like it because of the opposite in it, really, and it's black and silver and kind of, and it's got this serpent motif on it. Yeah, it's nice. Gentler than the drum sometimes for helping people move in and out of things. I do sometimes use my drum. So, let's look at where we are. You'll notice the difference in the table space this morning, because the sword is unsheathed and the grail chalice is unveiled. So I suppose in a way what we're looking at, we spent a day yesterday looking at the wasteland. And today really we look at the grail and some particular form called the mass of the grail. And at the same time what we're looking at is this whole idea of commemoration, of remembering. So I want to look a little bit about with you at what is it to remember, even in a kind of simple way. You know, what is it to remember yesterday or to remember somebody in our life? Because that apparently simple act in itself is a profound act of creativity. And a slightly paradoxical thing, because what you have to do when you remember is make the past present in some way. Even when you remember a fact, or even that simple thing, where did I put my keys? Great cry in the Reese household. Or rather, Alison, where have you put my keys? Because it's sort of, she never has, it's always me. Yeah. But it's sort of, you know, but I don't like to start from that place. You know, it's always a cue. It's you know, been together for a long time and accuse the other person of having done the thing that you've done to yourself. It's an old habit. But that very act, once I get past, what I have to do is first of all remember. I have to remember that it's me. There's a whole process that happens in that, you know, that small little thing that gets played out between me and my wife quite regularly. In that first place, I am massively spun out, of course, because I'm blaming the outside world. I can't find my keys. Somebody, Al's the convenient person, has stolen my keys. And in a way, that's this whole process of moving inwards is, you could say, a process of taking sovereignty of our own inner world and taking responsibility, not in a heavy way, but in an appropriate way for who we are and the world that we live in. Because that very first place that I do, of blaming Alf for stealing something she hasn't, is I think something that happens a lot in the world, right? It's that place of, it's not me, it's you. And that happens in small, intimate things in human life, and of course it happens on the global stage. It's, you know, it's odd this weekend. We sit here this weekend with this hellish thing continuing to go on in the Ukraine. We sit here with the ground assault in Gaza, in Israel, was upped last night. So that place in a human being where we blame the other and cannot contact ourselves or our own relationship to the continuity of things, our inability to remember, is at the root of much of the problems of the world and much of our personal problems. Because instead of moving inwards, you go outward with it. Ali, what have you done with my keys? I haven't done anything with, and you know, sort of, you know, back to my personal situation. I haven't done anything with your keys. Why do you always accuse me of stealing your keys? I never touch your keys. Yes, you do. And then I remember one incident out of 100, right? So that sort of, which I have clearly to hand, and say, what about that? So, and then things start to go a bit downhill gradually, because actually Al then starts accusing me of things, and we start to spin out from each other. What happens there is we're increasingly, although we appear to be relating with each other, we're not at all. We're relating to fantasized images of the other. We're relating to fantasized history of our own. And in a way, that act of... what happens is not remembering, but dismemberment. So more and more we spin out, more and more the world breaks apart. And when we come to these very powerful stories, like the story between the Arabs and the Jews, or if we look at the situation in the Ukraine, and you look at things like the Balkan situation, these very ancient collective stories come into the personal stories, energize them, and that energy of blame is then manifests in terrible actions. Now, the whole thing about what we might call the Mass of the Grail, or the experience of the Grail, is this process of remembering, of putting together opposites, and of moving from the fantasized and externalized action of blaming and projection into the movement into depth, into actual relationship with ourselves and what's actually going on. You could say, if we're going to use a biblical metaphor, that that act of blame that is really a deeper and deeper entanglement in this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, more and more separating, splitting, branching out more and more and more, till we don't have any connection really with any root or ground. Now, what we're doing is something different. We are connecting things back together. We're coming together in a way into the connection with the living tree. So that's the tree you find, James, in the middle of the wasteland, right? The tree of life that brings everything into relationship, the interlocking streams, maybe, or the capacity to be with this and that, without naming this as good and that as bad. Now, Hebrew word for to remember is zakor. It's an interesting name. It's the same root as you find in Sufi tradition of zikr. And at one level, zakor, like zikr, is the repetition of a divine name to connect you back to the divine. But the actual structure of zakor is an interesting. It's formed of three Hebrew letters: the letter zayin, the letter keth, and the letter resh. The letter Zayn comes originally from a pictograph meaning the sword. The letter Keth means a fence or a sacred enclosure, an enclosed place. The letter Resh means head or origin. Now, the word is actually derived from an image of the Garden of Eden. It's the enclosed origin place, the enclosed place that is the center of creativity, guarded by the sword. So it takes us right back to that image. The word, so the, in the Hebrew, the word remembrance, therefore the word zakor, really brings us into a very direct relationship with this image of the expulsion from the Garden of Eden and the possible return to the garden. And the Kabbalists had a sort of had this kind of created this diagrammatic image, which I'm just going to run us through briefly, which just helps me to remember the processes that happen as we remember in this way. So I'm going to do that on the board here. I'm just going to get rid of this for a moment. Put it up there later if we need it. So. This would look like a diagram going upwards, but it's actually, in reality, it's a movement into depth. So actually, if we can imagine it almost going inwards rather than going up. The Tree of Life image, the Kabbalists use, obviously it comes from the image of this tree in the middle of the garden. But it came together with kind of Neoplatonic thinking about of an image that represents both the external universe and the internal universe. So the image they use is an image of a tree growing up from the earth that holds the planets within its branches, and its crown is in the fixed stars. So the idea of it's like a bridging image that represents aspects of the human soul and represents aspects of the greater universe and acts as a bridge between the universe that we live in and the internal universe. So it's a bridging liminal kind of image. And at the bottom or the outermost part, you have a sphere meaning being the earth, which is also the body and the senses. And if you like, below this or outside this, more accurately, is the outside world. Because we're going to look at the internal thing for the moment. Now, when I do, where are my keys, Ali? Instead of going inwards, I move out of this place. I move out of connection with my body and senses, out into a place that the Kabbalists called the Klipot, which is the world of fragments. It means the world where there is no sense and no connection. And that's kind of literally kind of what I'm doing. I'm moving into a sort of fantasized history, an image of myself and an image of the world that's generated from deeper within my personality, but is projected out into, because what I'm not doing in that moment is I'm not actually sensing my body and getting present. I'm in a purely reactive aspect of my own history. Because I move, instead of sensing, okay, if I don't even really hear the question where are my keys? I just feel, I just immediately, keys aren't there, I'll take my keys. You know, she only ever did this once in her life, she took my keys to work, but actually because of other things that go on in my history, there was a powerful charge, so there's a lot in that for me. So I'm in this world of fragmentation, but which I perceive as being coherent, but it's held in place by my belief that I am innocent and else to blame. Right? So that projection outwards of the internalized image or history is what holds that place in a coherent place. Though actually it's kind of mad. It's got no relationship to reality at all. In actual reality, she has done nothing at all with my keys. I have done something with my keys. No answer is going to be found. Productive answer is going to be found in my demand that she tell me where she's put my keys, because she hasn't done anything with my keys. But in that moment, for me, at my end of it, it has its own coherence. Now, in order to stop, and so the whole battle gets waged there, and eventually I kind of, you know, I get defeated and I realize, and so I have to come to myself, I have to come to a sense of myself. And what I have to start to connect to is well, what's underneath this? And I say, what's immediately underneath our body and our senses is another sphere called that's related to the moon, that's related to memory. Historical memory, and it's called the great storehouse of images. And it contains with it my sort of many thousands of images, thousands of experiences that are compressed images, my sense of myself and my sense of my world. It connects to the planet here called Mercury, which is our my ability to think and reason. Another sphere here to do with Venus, my emotional life. These two are also, of course, connected together. There's also a connection between mind and body, as we know. There's also a connection between emotions and body. So what we have here is a little kind of, if you like, a sort of construction. It's the underpinning of our kind of sense of ourself. This is the dynamic underneath that place of you've taken my keys. Because what actually happens is when these places are connected, and there's a, and if they're connected to something deeper, because what the Kabbalists also say, there is a sort of, so this is like the outermost part of our personality. They say there is the veil, here they have something they call the veil of the temple, which is a sort of something we have to get past in order to reach another aspect of ourselves, which they call the place of presence. This is the sun. So this is the place, slightly deeper place, connected with the heart, connected, because the word they give to us, we're called Tiferet, it's beauty. And it's the beauty of balance and connection and relationship. It really is that sense of presence and stillness. But we often can't get to that, because what happens here, and actually what this veil is made up of, is a disconnect from the body in particular. So if these things, if the mind, the feelings, and the imaginative nature that contains memory is not connected to the body, what you get is a sort of a spinning kind of maelstrom of thought and feeling and image, all based upon memory of the past, which sort of eclipses the actual sense of the body and the senses. And that, and the pressure of that energy, unless it's connected to the body, which slows this down and enables that deeper connection to the place of the sun, it becomes this kind of, it becomes this rather mad maelstrom that's continually being projected out, that's continually recycling the wounds of family and history, and pushing that out into the outside world. So in this small example of me and my keys, right, Alison becomes the enemy because she's taken my keys. And it's fueled not just by, and I get more and more irritable the more and more she denies this. Because actually it taps into other images. If you like, there's layers and layers of images and his compressed history here. And as that unpacks itself, and feeling gets unpacked, thought gets unpacked, a whole creative world appears. So you create a world. If I'm not careful and don't interrupt this, what starts to happen, and together we start to create a world where we really hate each other, because we keep on misunderstanding each other, we keep on betraying each other, we keep on letting each other down. Lots of thoughts about that come to mind. Everything gets very energized. Lots of images from the past, feelings from the past. So you start off talking about the keys in the room, and then suddenly you're talking about the fight you had 6 months ago, and then how do we ever come to get together? All that kind of images, all this stuff comes into the room, right? So this whole world comes in. Of madness, of clipotic, fragmented madness, but which is given coherence by the fact that we're applying our will and our imagination, which in a way are the energies of the sword and the cup, to bring this world into being. And of course, if we're not present in any way, we do this all the time. You know, we get triggered all the time. Traveling in my car is one of my best. This is one another great place for me. That kind of the I probably said this at another time. Classic time for me when I was really kind of
And I do get a bit reactive. I'm in the car. If I feel people are cutting me up, I was. But it culminated on one occasion where I really did get into trouble, where I found myself suddenly leaning over and giving and shouting and giving the V straight into the face of a traffic cop who was parked, who was just directly alongside me. And in a moment, I came to full presence, but not before my hand. If I'd come to full presence a moment earlier, it would have been okay. My hand wouldn't have. And of course, then he completely pulled me over, took me apart, found I'd this wrong. My oh God! That's kind of the problem, right? Where these energies are very, very profound. There's a sort of secondary spin that goes on here, that's pushing out all the time. That in a way, this is, if you like, the restless dead of our own nature. And what we're trying to do is to work against that, actually, because what we're trying to do is to come, that's why we come into the, that's why the body is crucial here. The body is the anchor. The body is the access place. The body connects. Because what we're trying to do, what we have to do, if we're going to not have that going on, is we have to come into some actual sense of our body and our senses, a sense of, so if I think of the thing with Al and the keys, what I notice is I'm anxious, I'm scared, I'm not going to, where's my keys, I won't be able to, so I come into that sense of agitation. As I come into that sense of agitation, things start to slow down a bit, because I'm not just accelerating and pushing everything out. We stop fighting, so I'm not getting stimulated in the same way. So everything starts to calm down. And what starts to happen is these links start getting made, is I start to think and feel more in relationship to the present. This bit calms down, because this becomes this massive thing, because this actually expands. This set of images become enormous and pushing out. So that shrinks. Because actually what it's supposed to be like is the reflective pool. That reflects the deeper parts of our nature, and when it functions, it connects thought to image, it connects feeling to image, it's actually a very crucial kind of part of our nature. It's connected profoundly to our body image and our sense of the world, and as that becomes, it becomes a reflective place, rather than this turbulent sea that's overwhelming everything. So it's very much connected, the image here is very much connected to water. As that happens, as everything starts to calm down, this kind of link between the sun place starts to happen, the moon starts to reflect the sun. The connection, also the sun bit also starts to connect to our thinking nature and our feeling nature. So actually everything, so if you like, the image almost is of the sunlight starting to shine into the thought nature, into the feeling nature, starting to illuminate the conditioned imagination. So that everything becomes stiller, more reflective and more lucid. So everything becomes more present, more sharper edged, more awareness starts to appear. Now, what the Kabbalists would say, if that starts to happen, then a sort of a deeper aspect of our nature starts to appear, which they identify by the slightly outer planet, more outer planet, planets of Mercury and Jupiter. Mars and Jupiter, sorry. So Mars is the energy of, it's a sword energy of clarity or will. Jupiter is the planet of love and compassion. So what starts to happen is the thinking nature, as it becomes illuminated, starts to have that kind of sense of clarity and directionality of Mars. The turbulent emotional life starts to open up into that greater sense of love, acceptance, compassion. It broadens out. The connections start to happen here between the ability to be compassionate and the ability to become clear. These energies start to feed the heart place, the place of presence. So the whole system starts to become both simultaneously more expansive and wider and more energized, because there are kind of deeper energies coming into it. If we hang out in this place, they say, well, actually something else starts to happen. And here you come to this very mysterious place that the Kabbalists call Da'at, which is a Hebrew word that means, it kind of means the knowing that is not knowing, or the knowing that's like sexual union. It's a word for, it's like a biblical phrase of the man knew the woman in a sense of sexual penetration. The woman receives the man in the sense of receiving that. So it's a knowing through union, through being at one with something, not the knowing of separation. But that is also a place of mystery and surrender. So there's a sort of something deeper kicks in as we come into this place, and we come then into what they would say is our deepest sort of roots, which we have up here. And here the deepest root would be the archetypal mother, Ama or Ima. Here we have the archetypal father, Abba. In a sense, here is archetypal will, here is archetypal imagination. So it's the sperm and the womb. So these are all the opposites. And here is, if you like, the deep root. It's called Keter, the crown, with the crown of the tree that is also the root of the tree. So it's crown and root. So it's our deepest kind of connection to a sense of who we are. Now, what we do when we do this practice of paying attention to our body and paying attention to images in the way that we've been doing it is we move through this whole process. Because what you find initially is that you have to come into connection with the body. And often that's not easy. There's a part of us outside, wondering about our outside things, so there's a sort of resistance you hit there. There's also, once you do get present, first of all, the first thing that you hit normally is a lot of turbulence, internal turbulence. A lot of thoughts, feelings, random images. And so there's a sort of need just to stay with the process, to allow it to kind of settle and still itself, and to allow ourselves to persist so that we can let the images, let the turbulence of the moon place settle, so it starts to reflect that deeper sense of stillness. Now, as we touch that deeper sense of stillness, our whole system starts to open up. And we become present, more centered in the middle of our experience. So our mind starts to experience clarity and insight. Our emotional life, however, even if we're dealing with quite painful things, starts to get held in a larger sense of acceptance and compassion for ourselves and compassion for the world that we live in. Now, as we relax into these places, then we start to touch into a deeper kind of mystery. We start to come into the unknown. And what happens as we come into the unknown, we can then go into this very mysterious place where we encounter this bit at the deepest level is always in relationship. So these are non-separate. So the sense of the ground of our being, the Kabbalists have this way of saying that the mother and the father, our archetypal will and imagination are constantly making love. They're constantly in union with each other. So we're touching really the place really that's represented by the sword and the cup together. You could call it the generative mystery, in a way. So the idea that they have is that deep in the heart of our being, we are these generative beings that underneath all the complexity, all the apparent kind of lostness and stuff that we all have to do, there is a deep coherence. Because that sense of Keter, they say it is the Yachida, my deepest sense of me. The deepest, if you like, almost the sort of single point that is out of which all of me comes, the root, the deep root of me that expresses itself through will and intention and through the womb-like nature of the deep imagination. So these two qualities So the connection to our root and our act and our relational qualities of will and imagination come together and are expressed through this place of mystery. Now, if you look at that diagram, it is kind of symmetrical, except that the body bit looks, so you've got these two triangles and the body bit is just tacked on the ends in a way. Yeah, so it looks like it's a bit unsymmetrical, and that's the Kabbalists would say that's because we have become too externalized. We have kind of lost our true place, because they say where the true place of the body is actually here. So this is the body. The body actually is not this externalized edge of things. It actually is this very mysterious, deep place. And actually, its true place is there, connected to the deep archetypes of our being, and from the body, in connection with the spiritual root, with the deep will and the imagination, from that our sense of love flows, our sense of clarity, our presence of being in the world. Thought and feeling arise out of the connected body, and the images that we meet the world with. So this place is also, the moon place is also called by the Kabbalists the foundation. Hebrew means yesod. So actually, it is the foundation. So the place, because actually when we come into real connection with things, the world is much more moon-like. It is a fluid, moving world. It isn't this solid, fixed thing. So actually, when we're in our right place, when our body is, our experience of bodily life is in its right place, actually when we're deeply in touch with the body, we're in a very deep place inside ourselves, and everything else are our tools of relating to the fluidity, to the flowing of the fluidity of the outside, of the apparently outside universe. Our problem is that we keep getting pulled out of this by the movement of our history, thought, feeling, memory, and our sense of a fragmented self and a fragmented world. Each time, however, we make the connection between ourselves and move into the deep place, we strengthen that capacity to do that. So we enable ourselves to trust a little more that movement into the inner. Now, one of the problems of our society is that not only do we massively distrust the imagination, we massively distrust the body. You know, the body, part of the images of the images of original sin that Christianity holds, but even the sort of instrumentality of science in some ways, the body is seen as this object that isn't much valued unless it's very beautiful and conforms to very particular standards of beauty these days. But even so, it's still objectified. So the body, our problem is the objectification of the world, objectification of ourselves, where this is an act of pure subjectivity, of actually trusting, seeing the body actually as this mysterious place that holds within it actually everything else, right? So it holds all these other presences within us and is in deeply in touch with these very mysterious energies of imagination, will, and the sense of centeredness that is connected to everything. And the great beauty of the body is every time you come into contact, well, your conscious mind will not know it, but actually every time you just touch into through your breath and body, you are immediately in relationship with the wholeness of everything. And the work, in a way, is a lot of the work is about how do we clear ourselves here? How do we slow down this constant spin, this constant... I mean, Carlos Castaneda, in his early writings in the 70s, talked about it as the internal dialogue. And it is that constant... The problem is we are constantly using our creative energies of will and imagination to keep recreating a world of separation for ourselves. And if you just listen to yourself, you watch, you will see that dialogue going on, particularly if you're feeling hurt or upset. The power of that dialogue, you know, so the stupid example of the keys, you know, it can take me right into my childhood where nobody understands me, nobody listens to me, nobody answers me. You know, the, and I feel that, and not just think that, I feel that. I have images of that. I know that's a reality. I bring that world into being. You know, another example for me is when I'm in Tel Aviv, me and taxi. I have this terrible relationship with taxi drivers in Tel Aviv. Because this sort of, which I actually understood the factual route over the first time, this having got there 14 years, it's embarrassing. But I have, for years, I go and teach at the university in Tel Aviv. I have a fight every time I go there, I have a fight with the taxi driver. So, you know, every morning, not so much the evening ones are right, every morning I have a fight with the taxi driver. I actually understood the factual route of it this time. There's a confusion in the way Tel Aviv University numbers its gates. And so when I say, if I say gate 17, which I know isn't the gate next to gate 14, they wanted to be next to gate 16, which is the other side of the university. Israelis don't really listen to, it's still a problem, because Israelis don't listen to foreigners, because they think they know better. They've got a very strong feeling of knowing better than foreigners. But I have never understood this. I've never understood why they just wouldn't listen to me. And I didn't know the factual confusion. But where it would take me is it took me into the place, a very powerful childhood place of nobody listens to me. And Israel is a kind of edgy place. I'm slightly paranoid much of the time in Israel in any way. Cause you know, so, and the other thing in my own history is I don't like being driven much. I can bear being driven by somebody I trust, but I like to be in control. I like to drive. I mean, I love driving, so it's one of my things. I really don't like taxis that much, and it's not practical for me to hire a car in Tel Aviv. It would be a nightmare. So immediately I step into the taxi. I don't really like being there, and I want to be in control. There's a factual confusion about me and them, and kind of, so we're dealing with something factual. So instead of being, I don't know, because partly I just think they're being, difficult. So I've never, until recently, found out, well, what is the problem here? So I've not been present enough with it to understand, well, why does this keep happening? Because I go back to the childhood place, it keeps happening because nobody ever listens to me. Right, so that's the reason. So for 14 years, I've had this process of fighting with people in Tel Aviv, taxi drivers in Tel Aviv University, over my childhood. And they no doubt are fighting with me over something in their experience about how foreigners are difficult, or I don't know, whatever that is. Right, but until we decouple these things, until I can become more present and then more reflective, but to do that, I have to listen to the experience of my body, which is telling me this is telling me all kinds of things. They're telling me I'm upset and angry for sure, but it's also telling me when I listen to this, there's something off here. Listen to yourself. What's going on? And somewhere there was enough space in me this time to think, oh wait a minute. Gate 17 is next to gate 14. Gate 16 is the other side of the university. They think they're right, and there's a whole thing in Israel where people want to be right, and I really like being right. So we completely create this world together. Mad, clipotic, fragmented world where we end up screaming at each other. You know, so, and I'm there, at Tel Aviv University, I teach Buddhist psychotherapy, right? So I'm teaching Buddhism, meditation, calmness. I arrive screaming at people and sort of slam the door and I'm saying things like, fucking Israelis want to come to this fucking country, they never fucking listen to me. And then I sort of sit down on my meditation cushion and I'm in a, hello. Let's talk about compassion. But that's the sort of madness, right? That's what happens. And of course, the madness has its own coherence. It's not that I'm randomly mad or randomly angry. What it is is a profound and painful coupling of my creativity with the other person's creativity to create a universe of misunderstanding and pain and anger and hurt. So the key piece in this work, in a way, is to recognize that we are exercising our will and our creativity all the time. But actually what we're doing is relating out of hurtness and history rather than relating out of presence and connectedness. And in a way, the whole business of the Grail and the Grail story is all about this. It's all about the wasteland, the place where everything has gone wrong, and the need for something else, the need for something that will hold things differently, that will provide a different quality of relationship, that will provide, that will enable, in particular, that will enable flow. The thing that the image that they use in the medieval Grail stories and the Arthurian stories is the dry land, the land without flow. Right, so this place where I'm fighting with the poor old taxi driver and he's fighting with me, there is no flow, there is no connection, there's no moisture in our relationship. It's absolutely abrasive. You know, like we're rubbing sandpaper on each other's skins, right, and sort of annoying each other and angering each other. There's a lot of heat. So the image that, but what happens as we connect more deeply, we come into relationship with flow. And we come into relationship in particular with something that they call the Grail Hallows. And the Grail Hallows are these mysterious kind of life-giving objects. And one of the particular quality that's around when the Grail is present is that people are given, it's a nice image really, people are given exactly the thing they like most to eat in the world. The thing they are fed with the very precise nourishment that they most need. So the Grail is this mysterious kind of object that keeps changing. And the story is always about something having gone wrong, some aspect of the wasteland having appeared, and the search for something that makes an enormous difference to it all. And it's interesting, this whole image of search, really, because in terms of our extroverted kind of society and the commercially driven aspect of our society, we all do lots of search. I do lots of searching. I don't include you in it necessarily. Where you, for something you want outside yourself, the good book, perhaps. If we're talking about me, we're talking about the really excellent book that I next want to read. Or it could be, the other thing it could be is a really excellent brandy. And so clearly wanted to reveal all my shameful secrets here. I had a little experience of how my wish for something outside myself can undo me in a different way. I was waiting to fly to Israel. I was at the Sofitel. I'd sort of had this hustly kind of journey, and I had a meal, and I was going to the bar. And I thought, and I was in that kind of expansive place I can get into just when I'm well fed and I'm just about to go on a flight, and I'm not very connected with anything real, really, certainly with any presence, because I wouldn't have done this if I didn't. And I think, well, I'd like a nice brandy, I'm gonna have a large brandy. I think to myself, that would be very good. I'll have a large brandy, nice way to end the day, and you know, prepare myself for the flight tomorrow. And I go to the guy, and he says, "Well, would you like an XO Martell brandy?" I said, "Oh, I've not had that." I think to myself, that sounds splendid. I'll have a large one. And he says, "A large one, a normal large one. You sure you want a large one?" "Yes, I'll have a large one." I say, "Excellent, better and better. Go for it. You know, quadruple, splendid." So he pours it, and I taste it. Oh, very nice. Nice smooth brandy. Very good. Very happy. "Can I just get you the pills, sir?" "That'll be £75," he says. And of course, I'm suddenly not in the bliss of the brandy. I'm in the having to hand over £75. I'm also in the oh shit, I'll have to, because my Israeli host will not be paying for this, but they do pay for my hotel. So I have to hand the bill over to them as a way of proving that I've spent the money. And what I have is a bar bill that they were in excess of £75. So I suddenly come into reality. I enjoy the brandy, not as much as I was enjoying it before, because it's now, this is a brandy that's cost me £75. It certainly isn't a £75 brandy. I don't know what that would be like. But so I'm still having this bitterness with my sweet brandy. And then I have the humiliation of having to explain to my Israeli
Israeli host why my bar bill looks like I got absolutely rat-assed the night before I fly out in order to go and teach with them. So sort of, and this is the way these things sort of happen, right? These things are very powerful. It's very hard to stay present. There's a lot of stuff these days about mindfulness, getting present, and as if it's an easy thing. It's incredibly difficult to do. It is easy to do in a moment. It's really difficult to stay present, because all this stuff here is immensely powerful, and actually, making jokes about it a bit, it's also, these things are based upon early pain and distress, and they have and trauma, and so they what they're trying to do is provide us with a coherent image of the world. Because what we will have experienced is aspects of the wasteland, is the sort of the brokenness of the world, which we have to find a way to put together in a way that enables us to remain living. So we put together these strange versions of the world, in my case slightly paranoid versions, and sort of which is at the root of, I'll take my keys, taxi drivers are taking me places I don't want to go, and people don't understand me. I have needed to do that in a way to make my world safe enough for me to live in it. And as we reclaim these images, and as we approach, what we have to do in a sense, it is this journey that we make across the wasteland to the perilous chapel, the place where we can experience the possibility of healing, which also brings us to the place of origin of wounding. So in a certain sense, you could say we follow both the life-giving water and the place of wounding across the wasteland. That's literally what we did in the meditation this morning. As we go into the wasteland, we follow both the stream of life energy and the stream of the wounded energy that takes us to a place of origin in the garden. Then the garden is the deep place, really. The garden is the place where the garden is home. It's the place where we lie down and are in touch with the deep green life. It is also simultaneously the place where we are, where the deepest wounds are. It is the place where we find the wounded king. And it is the place where the mystery starts to unfold itself. Now, for all of you in your different ways in that meditation, as you come to that place, that hall, that garden, something unfolds itself. Something, you're present with something that is deep and mysterious. And by being in that place, and by sitting in the chair, by participating in the mystery of that, something then starts to unfold that impacts these outer places in our personality, that makes connections where there were not connections before, that settles places that have been turbulent before. And the grail legends, the Arthurian legends, are quite difficult in some ways. They're very complicated, and there's lots of, but they're interesting because they're again imaginal ways of describing this territory. They're not describing it in the way I'm just describing it, in this very psychological way, but it was at that time a way of people, and this was an underground tradition within medieval society, that was a way of acknowledging deep images and deep wounding that wasn't being held within the outside culture. Because if we go back into sort of pre-Socratic times, you have a world where people are very in touch with these ancient images. So the movement between the archetypal and the personal was very kind of open. And if you ask the Greek why they did something, it was perfectly acceptable to say, a god made me do it. Why did you accuse me of stealing your key? Ian, why did you accuse me of stealing your keys? A god made me do it, Ali. Now, pre-Socratic days, Al would have said, okay, right, fine, okay, well, let's talk to the god. I suggest that to Ali. Don't think it's going to scan. Because we've lost that connectedness with that deeper world. So what happens through the development of Christianity is the development of the monoculture, of the monotheism, the externalized god. And what we have is the image of the sinful human soul and the life, and the inability then to trust the internal It's all about the obedience to the church, obedience to the law, and the performance of the external action. Now, simultaneously, you have these various traditions, of which the Kabbalah and the Grey Legends are just a couple, that are addressing it on a much more internal level. So the Grail story is a way of people remembering, again, remembering, connecting with these deeper kind of energies. I'll talk a bit more about this afternoon, but the version that I've been looking at more recently is this version written just across the way in Glastonbury Abbey. Now, partly I'm looking at it because it's just local and it's just interesting, but more interestingly, the thing that this story is most concerned about is something it calls the performance of the Grail Mass, which is the act of commemoration. Some of the other stories, it's a bit like you find the holy cup and it solves everything. Whereas actually the Percival, it has much more this sense of a process and of something that you participate in that enables you to keep connecting to a sense of goodness and to a sense of waste and wasteland. It makes it a hellishly complicated book, because every time you think you've come to the end, it starts again with something else. It's the spiral. It's the constant spiraling energy. So it's those of you who are doing the Arwen training will be looking at the Percival in some depth. I don't recommend it unless you really have a good ground in this. It's a nightmare book because it keeps on spinning round itself. And the main thing to get from that is the process it's trying to convey. That actually every time you come to the end of the process, it starts again. With some of the later Grail romances, what happens is particularly the one where with Galahad in it, Galahad finds the Grail and goes to heaven. It's a closed. It's actually the sort of that external story coming on top of the Grail of the earlier Grail story, which is actually a story of repeated alchemical processes. Because what happens in the beginning of the Percival is, I can't know how to say it. I used to be able to say it when we started to discuss what it is. Sound like Percival. I'm going to call it the High History of the Holy Grail. It's easier. That's his English title. The High History of the Holy Grail begins with Arthur and his kingdom in disrepair. And it begins really with a sense of nothing's really working. Kind of like modern day Britain with Cameron in charge. Nothing's really working. Because vision has become lost. So it's an interesting book because it starts, the problem it defines right at the beginning in terms of our work is that Arthur has lost a sense of vision and everybody, all the other knights have lost vision. They've all become slobs eating McDonald's and hanging around Camelot and sort of not bothering to go out on quests anymore. They've got no vision, they've lost vision. And right at the beginning of the book, there's a very powerful piece that happens where his squire, who is the son of somebody called Owain. Now, in the earlier Welsh traditions, Owain is the great shamanic knight. He is the knight who goes off into the forest and fights with the lord of the forest. And he becomes, in a way, the knight of the goddess of the forest. So this book introduces this figure, the son of Owain. And in some senses, we could all be called the sons and daughters of Owain. So we're not directly in touch with that shamanic energy. We're at one remove. Now the son of Owain, the squire who is the son of Owain, is inspired by listening to Guinevere. So basically you get the Guinevere giving Arthur a hard time at the beginning of the book for having lost vision. It's your fault, Arthur, you've become this lazy old bastard lying around and all the knights are now lying around like you. That's why nothing works in this place anymore. And Owain hears this and he decides that he will go with Arthur. Arthur's going to go on quest to put this right, to go to the chapel of St. Augustine in the Perilous Forest. So immediately Arthur is going to go off to the chapel in the forest, which is the place where the Grail might be found, in order to find new vision. And he decides that Owain, the son of Owain, will come with him to help him. In the middle of the night, Owain wakes up and is a bit disorientated and thinks Arthur might have gone without him, so goes off on his own.
But actually what's happening is going off in dream vision. This is all a dream within a dream. So he goes on his own to the perilous chapel, and he encounters a dead knight. So he encounters again, we're back with the mystery we've been looking at this morning. He goes straight into that place of the mystery. And what he does is to steal a candlestick. He decides he will take a candlestick. This is his error. He will take a candlestick to prove to Arthur, because Arthur's not there, to prove to Arthur that he's been there. So he tries to take something tangibly from that world into the inside world, outside world. As he comes out, he is confronted by the Lord of the Forest, the Black Oppressor, the Black Knight, who is the figure of his father. His father has mastered in the past, but he is wounded, sore to death, it says, by the Black Oppressor, and immediately wakes up, and he finds himself in a strange place. He finds himself dying, and he has the candlestick. So he has translated something from that world to this, but it has cost him his life. Now, right in that beginning of the High History, we're shown immediately the problem and the possible solution. And we're also shown the reality of vision. That something that happens in vision can powerfully affect the body, that something tangible can be taken from that world into this world. The book ends. It doesn't end with the Grail, it doesn't end with the achievement of the Grail. The book ends with a ruined castle, with two Welsh knights exploring a ruined castle that's fallen into disrepair, that was once the Grail castle. And in a way, the ending of the book takes us right back to the beginning, something that was powerful once that is ruined. It's saying to us, this book is like a ruined castle, and you have to explore this. And if you explore this ruined castle, which is simultaneously the ruined chapel, you will find the Grail. It might cost you your life to do that, which is what the first bit of the book tells us. Because your life will completely change if you do that, if you bring back, because in a sense his life as the squire to the king ends. He is now the guardian of the object that he has brought back. So he dies, and in his dying, it's his dying and death at the beginning of the book that galvanizes Arthur into making his own quest. So then this is the next thing that happens in the book, is Arthur goes off and encounters Black Knight, and this thing is repeated time and time again in the High History. Makes it a confusing and difficult book to read, but it's, in terms of our subject, it is a very realistic book. It doesn't say, right now you've got the Grail, now everything is okay. The two objects that are found in the end are the sword and the Grail, but the Grail is something that keeps changing. Its final change is into the chalice, because one of the things that we learn is that in Arthur's lands, in this destroyed land, there are no longer any chalices. There are vessels, but there is not the chalice. So the two tangible things that return in the end of this book is the sword of John the Baptist that has been broken and is reforged. So the sword is found and the chalice is returned. So these are, and in all these complicated adventures in this book, these are the two things that are found. This is the deep will and the deep imagination and the connection to the root of life. So while all these things can get very, very complicated, that in the end what we're trying to do, we come into relationship with the body. This connects us to all kinds of complications, but underneath that complication we find this energy of the sword and the chalice, perpetually conjoined, perpetually creative, connected to the deepest place in ourselves. And that place is perpetually creating our sense of self and the world we live in. So our need, in a way, is for sovereignty. Our need is to consciously relate to the generative mystery that is our deepest nature, so that we, instead of unconsciously creating a world of pain and difficulty, can create a world with lucidity, clarity, compassion, presence, mystery expressing itself. So that really is what we're doing. And we're doing it all the time in every moment. What we're using, these various tools, these books, these images, these things, is to put something different into this mix here, so that we can slow down and so that we can respond to the unfolding mystery inside us. Once we have that, we don't need the rest of this stuff. It just happens itself. But these things are very useful, because it's important, because actually the bridge across from the place of fragmentation to the place of connected mystery is really quite hard, and we need a lot of help. Boom, boom. In the words of that great archetype, the fox whose name I can't remember, Basil Brush, the immortal Basil Brush, who in the end is the being we must all bow to. Boom, boom. Voice of the thunder, data, data, davavin, Basil Brush. He is the man underneath it. We'll talk about Basil more this afternoon, because then I will really reveal the truth. The truth is Basil. Okay. God, that'll be hell, that cliffhanger. Shit, that's going to